Well, after so many nice presentations in biology, I will not dare to say a word in biology, but I will try to give you a flavor of what mass spectrometry could do for these kind of problems. Mass spectrometry is about details, but this kind of details which are very important for the activity of proteins and other active biological molecules. As I will show you, we can detect very, very minor differences between structures. So there are two kinds of mass spectrometry. Mass spectrometry dealing with molecules, and mass spectrometry dealing with cluster of molecules, so-called complexes. So we'll go through a series of things you can measure. You can measure masses with high accuracy. You can measure fragments, pieces, so that you can go back to the structure of a protein. This is proteomic analysis. You can identify a protein from eyepiece. If you work on complexes, you can determine stoichiometry. You can get information of protein-ligand interactions, on cooperativity, on the area in contact of proteins, changes in conformation. So-called molecular mass spectrometry deals with molecules. So you start with molecules in solution which could stick together by specific interactions. But you want to disrupt this interaction. You want to have data only on molecules. So this is so-called molecular mass spectrometry. And this was really made possible by the invention of electrospray by John Fenn in 89. And he had a Nobel Prize for that in 2002. And the only thing you have to know about that is that molecules are transferred from the liquid phase to the gas phase, and they carry protons. So they get charges, and with charges you can get mass measurements in a mass spectrometer. So I will just go through very rapidly through a series of examples of what can be done. Don't look at the biology, it's not the topic of the talk. The idea is just to give you ideas of things you can do in your field with mass spectrometry. This is just to show you that this antibody, which is 1,500 amino acid, was measured with an accuracy of a few ppms corresponding to plus or minus Dalton. So it gives you an idea of the accuracy you can get. And just it's interesting to see that this monoclonal antibody, which was on the market for 10 years when we measure it, was measured with a mass which is not corresponding at all to the supposed to be correct mass. We had a difference of 54 Dalton. So there is something different on the molecule. And this difference could be identified through the classical proteomic approach as a change in amino acid. So valine was replaced by alanine. It's not important today, but just remember that you can measure very little changes in molecules. So this is to summarize what we do in a classical proteomic analysis. You start with a very complex mixture, could be a very complex mixture of protein. You digest, usually trypsin and other usual enzymes. Then you run on this very complex mixture of enzyme, you run a chromatography. What is coming out from the column goes to the mass spectrometer. And then the mass spectrometer will select all the molecular masses of all these peptides. Usually you have 100,000 peptides in one mixture, at least. And on each of these selected peptide, they will get fragmentation by some specific device. And these fragments are in fact a kind of fingerprint, an experimental fingerprint of your peptides. And these fingerprints are compared through a series of soft search engines through a reference library. And I will comment on this reference library later on. So this is a classical way. So comments on the databases. Protein sequence database, or we have names of some of them here. In fact, they are made of less than 1% of data coming directly from proteins, which were purified, analyzed by different chemical ways, such as Edman degradation or mass spectrometry. They are made at more than 95%, actually 98%, are just predictions from the genomes sequence, and you know that very few genomes are fully sequenced, correctly annotated, very few. And there are so many genomes that we cannot hope that one day all genomes will be sequenced and deposited in these databases. Very few of these data here are verified at the level of protein, less than 1% actually. So it's a real disaster. In fact, most of the databases are incomplete, but they don't tell you. We have a lot of ORF which are missing or wrong. You have splicing which are wrong, missing, redundancy, and these databases are constantly updated. You never know which one you work. On Monday you work on one, 2 days after it's changed, and your results are not reproducible because you have changes. It's even not said. There is only one database which is making an effort. It's NextProt. It's from the people from SwissProt. Amos Bayrock is the guy who is pushing this. Any protein present has been fully verified at the level of the protein expressed. So it's not a kind of prediction. But there are obviously very few proteins in this database today. So this summarizes the way we so-called identify protein in the classical proteomic analysis. We start from the genome sequence. It's translated in prediction, and it's put in the databases. Then using some specific rules of fragmentation of peptides, a database with all the peptides, all the digestion peptide for one enzyme, from all proteins, from all databases, are predicted. The fragmentation of all these peptides are predicted. Then you start with your protein extract, digestion, peptide separation, mass spectrometry analysis, fragmentation, fingerprint, comparison by bioinformatic tools, and peptide identification. And that some other soft are putting together all these peptides so that you rebuild the different proteins which are supposed to be identified. But this is true only for data here, which correspond to something which is in the experimental data. What is not predicted will not be found. You are completely blind to unexpected structures. So there is only one way. It's a so-called de novo sequencing, which is still in its infancy. But if you don't do that, you get at least usually in such groups. So I was saying that the only way is to go through de novo sequencing, which is not easy. But if you don't do that, you will have at least 60 to 70% of the data, of the experimental data here, which are not interpreted. But if you look at this data, they are very good, very often. They are just not interpreted, which means that you missed a lot of, for example, oxidation, different degradation, or unexpected or unknown post-functional modification. They are numerous. So to summarize what you do when you explore a protein extract with proteomic analysis, you start with your protein extract. Then usually you try to purify different fraction. You can go through 2D gels, as it was just shown, 1D gel, any kind of chromatography, and then from these fractionation system, you get your digestion and the analysis of the peptides, or you go directly, if you have courage, you dare to go directly on the very complex mixture, but obviously you will not go deeper, so deep in the analysis of the proteome. And then you compare your experimental data with the predicted one, and you get your identification. There is another way, which is in our end very useful, in the immunoprecipitation, pull down something. This is obviously useful for a complex to identify the different partners of one protein. To have some time, we had good success with this. Oops. Two examples. We compare blood. We start this more than 13 years ago, this program, for trying to identify some biomarkers so that we can determine if it was, let's say, lymphopathy A or B. If it's A, it's one chemotherapy. If it's B, it's another one. So it's important to have a biomarker. So we compare for years a lot of samples. We could show that this protein was one biomarker. And by the way, it's important to realize that everything which is in red here corresponds to peptides which were clearly identified and quantified in comparing these two samples, for example. Each of them corresponds to one ELISA test. So this is the equivalent of 10 parallel ELISA tests. It seems very strong. But it's not, because everything which is not read has not been seen. So in proteomic, when we say a protein has been characterized and not identified, it means that every amino acid has been seen. Then you can be sure of what you said. You realize that, for example, let's imagine there was a splicing here. We would be blind to that. So imagine now what's going on when people are using just one antibody in an ELISA test to determine if this protein is there or not, and in which amount. So the study started in 2003, took us 10 years so that it started to be used in three hospitals, and now it's moving to other hospitals. We have now two of these biomarkers. We could go to very high complexity using the de novo sequencing. We could work on microbiotes, which are communities of bacteria, which are together building one way to transform. In this case, it's transforming arsenic-3 in arsenic-5. So each of these bacteria is bringing one or two enzymes so that the whole cycle can be done. So it's possible, but then you have to work very hard with a lot of people, believe me. Another example, we just noted that sortilin was involved in this business. So the right strategy, obviously, is to tag the protein you are interested in, and then by IP, you can have, you think, something rather clean. In fact, in this case, we identify clearly 50 proteins with different amounts. The right things to do is to go back, because specificity is not there always, have to go back to the biologist and ask him to do that. So then you tag other proteins and you do reverse IP, and then you get very clear answers. In this case, we could identify this list of proteins. Let's move now to complexes. What can we get from mass spectrometry for the study of complexes? And then the goal is obviously to keep alive the intramolecular interactions which built the 3D structure and the interactions between the different proteins or actors. So we know how to do it. It's you have to tune your instrument in some particular way. But the danger is obviously to build artifacts. If you measure the mass of this, you will get the mass of all these salts together with the mass of the proteins. And you can build some chimeric forms which are not existing. It's just to say that it's not so easy, but if you take care, it works. So you must build some control experiments. So I cannot say nothing about Jean Maillet, who was a professor in the Collège de France for years. He's responsible for this concept of supramolecular chemistry. And I would like just to show you that there is a very strong parallel between what was done. So we've been working with him from the characterization of these supramolecular edifices many years ago, a parallel between this kind of work and what's going on in biology. It's striking. Let's imagine this is protein A, protein B, protein C. And then you self-built, self-aggregation, self-organize this edifice. The question was, first, is it really this edifice? It's like this. We have to characterize it. Not very easy, even by X-ray in this case. But how is it built? What is the way to build it? So this is the kind of spectra we had. And the answer is done immediately. It's a kinetic study. So we have many, many do it every 2 minutes or every hour, depending on the temperature and so on. And we see that first we get that, then this, and that. So we have immediately, well, the final characterization of the main product, and we see how the edifice is assembled. We have the assembling pathway. So imagine that for one of your complex with many proteins. What about hydrogen bonds? These things should stick together because you can imagine easily that you can build hydrogen bonds here. But if you have protonation, you kill hydrogen bonds. So there is a trick, which was introduced by Jean-Marie Lane. It's the fact that you add something which can catch something with a charge, calcium. Then you get your charge, you can do mass spectrometry. And this is the result and the answer. Immediately, you see that you mix these two, the white and the black, instead of what was expected, which is a long necklace, a snail, or a linear snail, you get a six-member rosette here, and nothing else. So there is a driving force with cooperativity, which is very strong. And this is the edifice. So doing this, we know that 18 hydrogen bonds can keep everything together. So at that time, we just realized that we are under vacuum. And the vacuum, the epsilon, is very different than from water. And in vacuum, let's say, 3-4 hydrogen bonds are almost equivalent of one covalent bond in water. So we have to keep in mind that everything which is polar interaction becomes very strong in mass spectrometry because there is no more water. But everything which is entropy, hydrophobicity, is lost. So the result of the is that the stability of this edifice is due to everything which is polar, which is a way to say that then we can measure and compare polar interaction in vacuo. Cooperativity, protein A, protein B, protein C, when this is mixed, and when the chemist is clever, as Jean-Marie was, you get self-organized this. The question again was, do we have a cooperativity? So we do a titration experiment, one equivalent of copper, 2.5, 6. With 2.5, we are slightly under 3 equivalent, which is necessary in theory to do this, to build it. And what do we see? We see that at this point, the 3 peaks, which are labeled green, blue, red, corresponding to these 3 edifices, are with different intensity. And we know that the response factor are the same for the 3 edifices that's been shown. So, first, the most intense is the final product, then this one, then that one, which show that as soon as you have this built, the affinity of the copper for this part and that part is increased. It's a kind of cooperativity. So cooperativity, you know, is very important in biology. And we feel that, at that time, we feel that we could have a way to evaluate affinity on different enzyme system, and I will show you that in a few minutes. We can go to very large edifices. This is 16,000. And then the question is for proteins, what can we do? So now we move to proteins. These crabs are living at 3 kilometers under the sea, and some of our students went in this, this is the submarine which is in Roscoff, and they can catch some of these crabs. And it is known that these crabs have some different kind of hemoglobin. They are not hemoglobin, they are hemocyanins. So you bring the crab, with a syringe, we directly take the hemolymph, filter, and inject in the mass spectrometer. And the answer was, it was known that the monomer was 75,000 Dalton. We could show that we had hexa, dodeca, and so on, mers. And this is the spectrum, which shows us that we can measure up to more than 2 million Dalton. So the problem is not at all to measure high masses with mass spectrometry. The problem is to have a pure compound of 2 million. We tried with viruses. We thought, oh, that's the one thing. But we were wrong, because inside the body of the virus, you have a not defined number of water molecules, which are trapped. And then we do not have a peak. We have a hump, and we cannot measure what is the... So we need real molecules or complexes, as here. So I go briefly on a series of examples. This molecule was not to be dimeric, but it was not known how many of these dimers stick together to make... It was known that from microscopy that it was a kind of ring. And very easily from these peaks, you measure the mass and you show immediately that it's 10 units, or 2 times, or 5 times 2. It's easy to measure the dimerization of enzyme, and in this case, it was nice because at pH 6.8, we have dephosphorylation activity, and we have an exomer. If we move to pH 9.5, the activity is just reversed, but then we have dimer, mainly dimer. So the answer is obtained in 1 hour. We can follow the interaction between an enzyme and a ligand quite easily. This is the apoenzyme, and we measure the mass of this apoenzyme, aldose reductase. Then we add 1 equivalent of the cofactor. So we have the oloenzyme. And you see that everything is smooth. You add the mass of the cofactor in ADP. Then you wonder which inhibitor will go in the site and interact strongly enough so that it's not eliminated during the process of ionization. And you see here that, okay, again, the mass is increased by the mass of the inhibitor. Next question, will this inhibitor go in the site when the cofactor is not present, which is important because most of the enzyme is unloaded in the cytoplasm. It's empty. So it would be a bad idea to develop an inhibitor which would be wasted going in an empty hole with no activity. And then we could show that nothing happened, which means that that's a good inhibitor to be developed because this one will only stick in the holoenzyme and not in the apoenzyme. We can get information on the way, on the strengths of the interaction between this inhibitor and the site. And we know already that the strengths we will evaluate is the strength of the polar interaction, which is exactly what the people developing drug in pharmaceutical company need. They don't care about hydrophobicity because they don't have the end on this. The hydrophobicity is optimized for drugs by the so-called galenic. The molecule has to be soluble enough, but not too many. So this is for the so-called old-fashioned medicinal chemistry, but it's very important. The only aspect to be developed is the polar interaction. So this is exactly what we will get from this experiment. So what is done is to warm up the complex with the inhibitor in the protein. We warm it by some ways. So we turn a knob and we get voltages, so we know exactly how many volts of internal energy we give to the complex. And we wait till half of the inhibitor is kicked out of the site, which is the case here. So we go down 50. So we call this the voltage cone, the VC. In this case, it's 85 volts. And we compare this to IC50. In solution. So we do that for a series of inhibitors, and we see that as expected, when we compare, when we rank the strength, these inhibitors by the strengths, we have to shake them so that they kick out of the site. We see that it does not correlate with what's going on in the liquid phase with IC50. But as expected, no correlation. But when we, and we've been, not only lucky, but working hard, in this case, the crystallographers, the people from Dino Moraes in Strasbourg, could co-crystallize the four inhibitor in the site with a resolution of 1 angstrom, which is very high. And they could calculate the electrostatic and hydrogen bond interaction strengths. In this case, when we compare the ranking of the by the voltages applied, so the internal energy given to the site, and the electrostatic interactions, everything is fine. So really, it's a way to measure the electrostatic interaction in between proteins or between ligand proteins. Cooperativity, now not on supramolecules, but on enzyme, you know this enzyme, the tetrameric enzymes, and they have to be loaded with the cofactor. So the question was, for these different families of enzyme, do we have a cooperativity in the addition of this cofactor? Which means that if we have one in the site, will the second one have more affinity? The third one more or less affinity, or is it just statistical? Positive cooperativity makes an enzyme more responsive to environmental changes, and negative cooperativity has also a meaning in biology. So here we compare for the baker's yeast, ADH, with 1, 2, 3, 4 equivalents of the cofactor. We compare the ratio between the different species. So this is the spectrum as it is. Just look at that, it's easier. So these peaks correspond to the tetramer MT. Then we have 1, 2, 3 additions. This is the picture and the response factor. We've checked that they are identical for all the species. This is the ratio for the different species with one equivalent of the cofactor. With two equivalent, three. We see that it looks, and it is, we could calculate that, it is just statistical for this enzyme. So we were disappointed. But for the equivalent enzyme in the sturgeon muscle, we see that when we have, for example, just two addition, it's already odd. And it's when you look at three addition that it's really very clear. You see that you have two populations mainly. You have enzyme with no cofactor. And here we have enzyme with four. It's like in life. If you are poor, humanity is split in two parts. The poor stay poor, and as soon as you get a little bit of money, what's going on? You get a little bit of money, you can go to the stock, and immediately, very easily like that, you get very rich. So two populations. And this is another more complex example of life, I would say. It's a negative cooperativity at the end, but not at the beginning. So in this case, you get a little bit of money, and then you jump immediately to two units. I start to be rich, you become a little bit richer, but then it's very difficult to become very, very rich. So in these complex cases, you get at the beginning a positive cooperativity, and at the end, a negative cooperativity. So we solve. This is a very old paper, but we solved in a few days a problem which was there for years and years with all the other techniques. So really, I think for everything which is cooperativity, mass spectrometry is the one technique you should select. Here you have then what you have. It takes habit, takes time to look at the right data. These are the three states. Here you see statistic, positive, negative cooperativity. And the mean ligation states could be determined in 2 minutes. It's just the sum of all these peaks compared to this one. We move to the last novelty in mass spectrometry, is the so-called ion mobility. The goal is to measure the size of the volume, but I mean me like that and me like that. Running in a crowd, it's easier to run like this in a crowd than this. If you do that, you go slower. This is what is measuring this technique. But in the same time, we have the possibility to have the classical mass spectrometry running. So just to explain how it works, like this, you go slower. And the instrument is just measuring the so-called drift time. So you know if your enzyme is like that or like that. And we will see that. In this case, for years, people were trying to demonstrate that as predicted by some theoretical studies. When you add on this system, you have DNA, it's a repressor. So the two ends of the DNA are sticking to the proteins, but when you add this fructose biphosphate, it was expected to split the two proteins. The protein do not interact. The FBP was supposed to break the interaction between the proteins. It was not possible to see that by NMR, neither crystallography. So the answer was given very rapidly by mass spectrometry. The classical mass spectrometry gave no answer. And this is what you get with the so-called ion mobility. So in this direction, you have the classical mass spectrum. And in this direction, you have the so-called drift time, the time the system requires to go through the instrument. So just look at that. This is without the fructose biphosphate, and this is with. So if I go back, it just shows that it takes longer when the fructose biphosphate is sticking to the system. It takes longer drift time, milliseconds. You add something like 3-4 milliseconds. So that was considered as a final proof that the system is doing what was predicted by the theory. Also, in this case, we have so-called bispecific monoclonal antibodies to save money. Instead of giving people two different monoclonal antibodies, you mix them. And if you use the right family, IgG4, you have only two SS bridge. And just by adding a little bit of reducing agent, these SS bridge are reduced. And then you get an exchange of the two arms of the antibodies. And you have a mixed so-called bispecific, because this part will recognize one epitope, and the other one will recognize another one. But it's very difficult to measure the final result. So we did that by ion mobility and just changing. So you know that all antibodies has more or less the same structure. But just before the little difference in the variable part, we could see a difference for the time to go through this tube where you slow down what is larger than what is like this and not like that. So don't think about the biology, just think on what you can do on your system with this technology. This is to show you how you can show how a complex system is built, what is the sequence. So you have this guide, the RNA guide there, and you have a series of proteins sticking to this. To make a very long story short, I would say that you have to mix your RNA one by one with the different possible partners, so pairwise incubation. And you check here, you mix the RNA with this one, and you see that this is sticking. And you do that with other partners, so you can build a network, and you know, this one is going first, this one is going second, and then you mixed one in the proper order, everything, and you check that first that one stick, and only then the two other can come, and so on. So that's the equivalent of what I show you for Jean-Marie Lane's systems. But this ion mobility is also very useful for small molecules. Here we have a case which is really difficult to analyze. With other techniques, we have a peptide with two serines, two consecutive serines, and it happened that in the sample we had some of the peptide with no phosphorylation, some of the peptide with one phosphorylation, and some of the peptide with two phosphorylation. For this one, it was easy to quantify. For this one, it was easy to quantify and to correlate with the biological activity. Here, we were in trouble. We didn't know if this serine or that serine was phosphorylated, and we have no idea of the ratio. So what I will show you is that we can separate these two phosphorylation states, the first serine or the second one, with exactly the same molecular weight. So mass spectrometry can do nothing just by the fact that because one serine is not at the same place as the other one, the final result is a different size in space, different conformation, a more compact conformation from one compared to the other one. So I would just show you that we could separate the first one and the second one. Yep. And since they are separated by time, one is running faster than the other one. When this one is introduced in the mass spectrometer itself, we take the spectrum there, and then we can get the spectrum of the other one a few milliseconds after. So we could show, we could show the difference, and we know exactly which one is which one. So we know that here the serine is there and there. So we know exactly which. We can quantify both of the isotopologues. I'm gone. I'm through. Conclusion. Ah, thank you. So I think I've answered these questions. For you, I think this is the most important thing, not to miss some modifications. IP as are useful. Okay. So, that's it.